From WGN Radio Chicago, it's time now for Extension 720. Here now is your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And here indeed is Kirk Douglas. I welcome you most sincerely.
Well, thank you, Milton. Nice to be here. I'm glad I finally made it.
I've been watching you for years, and by golly, you do turn out to be Kirk Douglas. You know, someplace, I guess, is it in The Ragman's Son, your autobiography? You talk about some kid getting in your car, maybe a hitchhiker.
Oh, yeah. Saying, that's the story. When I was driving a little car to Palm Springs, and I saw a young sailor hitchhiking, and I was in the Navy, and he saw I stopped, and the little kid ran up, and he jumped in the car. He looked at me, he turned around, he said, "Do you know who you are?"
Yes.
And, of course, that's a good question. That's a question that, out of that, I thought that's a question everybody ought to ask themselves.
And, of course, that's the question around which your first novel, Dance with the Devil, just recently published, is constructed. The central character, Danny Dennison,
trying to find out who he is.
Is trying to find out who he
is. That's right.
And, of course, he has avoided who he is by an act of deception or duplicity taken a long, long time back. When we meet him, he's 55 years old. He's a Hollywood director. Back when he was how old? 13, is it?
When he's 13, he's leaving the San Saba concentration camp with a black American Marine is holding his hand. And as he's walking out, the black Marine looks at him and says, Jew? Yuda? And he says, no. He says, what's your name? And he just thinks of a gypsy name. His name was Moshe. Thinks of a gypsy name that he knew. He says, Daniel. And from that day on, Moshe decided he was not going to be a Jew.
Now, that didn't happen to you, yet there are autobiographical elements in this book, undoubtedly.
Well, I would think, Milt, that I'm not a professional writer, and I admire writers who can really write well, but I'm convinced that in every novel there are autobiographical elements. There are things that you pull out of yourself, things that you heard about, an amalgam of many characters that you know about that you put together. So I'm sure there's a mixture of things. But certainly, like somebody reads Dance with the Devil and says, are you Danny Dennison? I say, geez, no, I never went through, well, I may have gone through some of the things, but very few of them. It's a whole different character.
I hope you went through some of those sexual experiences, because there's a rich subplot having to do with...
Well, if I didn't, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
Sex is based on imagination, and I have a vivid imagination.
Either a vivid imagination or very rich experience or both. But there are some very torrid scenes in here, and indeed they are evocative, even for older readers like me.
But, Milt, like sometimes people say, they talk about raw sex, and I say, well, is there any other kind? You know, sex is sex. But I like to feel that in my novel, the sex is not gratuitous. I feel the sex scenes, which I am bold in, I must admit, but I think that it's a very integral part of the story. After all, if you have a man like Danny Dennison with his problem, who meets a young, attractive girl who's a prostitute like Luba, there has to be a sexual conflict.
Indeed, there has to be, and that's one of the two conflicts. The other is over that deception, which we've referred to, but we haven't said what it was. Well, yes, we have. He denies that he's Jewish.
Yeah, the problem of Danny's life is that he lives a lie. And I think many people do that. It doesn't have to be that they are a Jew and decide not to be a Jew. It can be lots of people live a lie. And very often they trap themselves at some early stage of their life, as Moshe did as a young kid of 13. I think, in my mind, I imagine that a young kid of 13 would say that.
Mm-hmm.
At the very beginning, when I start my character with Danny Dennison, that's why I have him talk to his sister Rachel, and he says to her, of course, she has now been working in the home of the Nazi commandant. Of course, the little boy, the brother, doesn't know that she's become the mistress of the commandant, and that's the way she can save his life. They've already lost their parents. But he wants to know, why are we here? And she says, because we're Jews. He's a little kid. He says, well, let's not be Jews. She says, what are you talking about? Your name is Moshe, and you're named after a famous Jew. He says, we're always Jews. But as he, you know, crawls into bed by himself, he thinks, he didn't want her to hear his thoughts, but he's thinking, I don't want to be a Jew. And I think, as an actor, I project myself into a young kid, and I think that's the way he would think.
And that's the way he would think under those conditions of utmost extremity. Jews persecuted by Nazis, and his parents and all the other Jews he knew killed during their incarceration in that extermination camp. In Italy, I hadn't known that there were any, but the San Saba camp in which you that did really exist.
Oh, yes, the San Saba concentration camp, which was a rice factory years ago, is in Trieste. I also, Milt, did not know. I was quite surprised. No. That's why it intrigued me. You know, you hear of Auschwitz and Dachau. I never heard of San Saba.
But here's what intrigues me with regard to this matter of that kind of denied identity. You've been in Hollywood for all of your career, though, of course, you've been back and forth on occasion with a number of commitments on Broadway and elsewhere in the theater world around the world. But you're one of our great Hollywood actors. You've always been identified as a Jew.
That's right.
Yet you come from a place where there are loads of Jews, some of whom probably have covered over their Jewishness, and if they haven't totally lied about it, have estranged themselves from it. And that must have had some influence upon your treatment of this theme in the book.
Hey, Milt, you're getting too smart, Milt. You see it all too clearly. That's true. Yes, I've seen that very often.
So tell me about the Jews of Hollywood.
Well, well, I'm one of them.
Yeah.
No, I tell you, I've seen that often, and it's sad. You see, it's sad, and that's what led me to this character. See, it's sad not only if it's a Jew. It's sad if anyone pretends to be something that he's not and tries to live that lie. That puts such a burden on you, and you have to purge yourself of that. And that's what, you know, Danny Dennison has to go through. You can't be a complete person. You can't become a mature person until you're capable of looking in the mirror and seeing some faults you have, some good points, and coming to the conclusion that the pluses possibly outweigh the minuses, and beginning to like yourself. I think becoming a mature person is at the point where you like yourself as a human being, and you can't like yourself if you're living a lie.
Have you seen Neil Gabler's book of last year? I think it's titled An Empire of Their Own. It's about the great Jewish founders of the Hollywood film industry.
Yes, yes.
The struggles they had with their own identity. Though they were Jews and all belonged to a particular Reform synagogue run by a particularly fashionable rabbi, their Jewishness was a kind of an estranged and vitiated Jewishness, which in fact made them unresponsive to the situation of most American Jews.
Well,
says Neil Gabler, whether he's right or wrong.
I think that's very true. You see, I sometimes have said that the only advantage I have found to being a Jew is that I can be openly anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
See, most people who are anti-Semitic, well, it's sort of, see, especially if you you refer to my autobiography, Milt, you know, in there, they say, oh my gosh, there was so much anti-Semitism when you were a kid. I said, I don't think it was worse then. I said, in many ways, it was much easier because the anti-Semitism was out in the open. You knew where it came from. Now I find that it's so hidden so often, you don't know where it comes from. And perhaps because of that, there are people in Hollywood, people all over, Jews who have decided, well, let's just play it down a little bit. I understand the reasons for it.
Yeah.
There's a torment to being a Jew.
There's also a torment to violating your own sense of what finally is moral and what finally is the good. And that's the other main theme, or it's one of the three main themes, it seems to me, in your new novel, Dance with the Devil. Dennison has been making schlock films. He does them very well. And indeed, he's playing a certain trick. He takes the plays of Shakespeare and
retwists them around and uses the plot of Shakespeare and makes a cheap little, you know, it's like taking Macbeth and decided, well, we'll make it two big landowners fighting over grazing lands, and you use the theme of Macbeth.
But he knows that in a way, though he does it well, he's been doing schlock, and he aspires to something higher.
Precisely.
But he feels he has sold out, as most people around him have done, in pursuit of their quick and highly profitable careers. And then there's the masterwork that he conceives to be his calling and his true denouement, or at least his ultimate necessary achievement as a true artist for the first time. The making of a film version of of all things, every man.
That's right.
In which every man, and we have this from, to what century does every man date? The 12th or 13th, I think?
About the 14th century.
14th century. And in every man, well, you tell it. You can tell it much better than I do.
No. You know, Milt, the interesting thing is
it deals with the price we pay at
the
end. It deals with the casting up of our account at the end of our lives.
Precisely. You know, it's a morality tale.
Yeah.
I mean, death approaches a man and says, you're going to die. Oh, my God. He says, geez, what's going to happen? He's facing death. Well, he has to make an accounting. God wants a reckoning. Well, what have you done in life? What are your good deeds? What are your bad deeds? It's a very simple morality tale. You know, most people think it's German because it's called Jedermann. It was done in Salzburg. Mm-hmm. But it's really an old English morality tale that the Germans, oddly enough, have adopted and made it their own. And it's much more effective. Done in Salzburg, in the town square in Germany. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. But that fascinating, because that plot fits so perfectly into what is Danny's dilemma. And I think very often in life we don't realize, you know, how clearly we glom onto something that is our problem. And he tries to use that to make his artistic expression.
And so, interestingly, he decides he'll reset it in Wall Street, of all places. Somebody points out to him there's another film titled Wall Street, which has done something like that. He says, yes, but this is going to take off from where that stopped.
That's right.
And, of course, there you're making reference to your son's film. At least your son was the leading actor in it.
Yeah, and he was pretty good in it.
He was quite good in it.
I think they gave him an Oscar for it.
They did, indeed.
Yeah, but... See, but my point is that in making that, that's why, you know, we were talking before, Milt, about, well, why did he fail in that? Well, he had to fail. As a writer, I felt he had to fail because the failure was not so much what he was writing. The failure was within himself.
The failure you're talking about is the failure of his film.
That's right.
At its preview showing, where everybody laughs it off the screen, as it were.
Exactly. They all made fun of it. And, of course, it was so humiliating, becomes the turning point.
By the way, was it, because you never quite commit yourself on this in the novel, was it really a bad film? Was it an artistic disaster? Or was it simply unappreciated by an insensitive audience?
Well, I have often thought about it. I didn't write about that, but I would say that probably it was a pretty good film.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that probably it was a pretty good film. And that if, you know, it's like a lot of things where somebody laughs at it and say, what a joke it is. Then you look at it again, you say, but you know, it had some very interesting ideas in it, but it didn't work. They didn't accept it. It didn't come off.
What's the best film you ever made that laid an egg?
Well, one of the films that I love that I produced in my own company was called Lonely Are the Brave. I wouldn't say that... It never made any money.
It's a great critical success.
But it developed into a great, it becomes a cult film now, but it never was, I mean, I thought it was a wonderful film. I think of that, I've done almost 80 films, I think of that as one of the best films I've ever made.
He's the last cowboy.
Precisely.
And he's finally run down, I remember this so vividly, in the last scene.
It was sort
by
of
a truck on a highway in which... What's his name?
Carol O'Connor. Was playing his first part.
Is that his first part?
Yeah, he drove
and he's
the
transporting
truck.
A load of toilets.
Exactly.
Isn't that right?
Exactly. That was, you know, to symbolize it, that was sort of civilization. That was our modern civilization, you know. And here was someone who loved nature. You know, he loved the outdoors. He didn't understand why should there be fences. He was a beautiful person. As a matter of fact, I probably don't like that because it's one of the rare... films in which I play a very nice character. Mm-hmm. You know, very often I'm a pretty mean bastard in a lot of the films. And this is one that I really play a nice guy.
Well, I don't know if you've ever done a full analysis of whether you're mean or merely intense or a good guy or whatever other categories there are. In a number of your films, you're a good guy, but you're very intense. And perhaps even a touch on the neurotic side.
Gee, Milt, I don't know. I have to think about that.
Well, Vincent van Gogh, you will agree, was not exactly a typical normal fellow down in the south of France.
No, but van Gogh was so pathetic. I mean, as a matter of fact, that movie, Lust for Life, made me so sad. It bothered me more than any movie that I ever made. Because anyone, you know, who's you know, tried to write a book or paint a picture or make a movie and has had constant rejections like you get in my profession. It's one of the reasons I've advised all my sons never go into show business. Of course, none of them listen to me. They're all in show business, but I meant it. I thought as a father, I got to tell them, look, it's show business is sad. It's poignant. It's tough. It's so hard to succeed, you know, but I'm delighted that in spite of my admonitions, they decided they wanted to do it. And I am delighted that they seem to be functioning pretty well.
I wonder whether you've retained, I bet you have, a continuing identification with Van Gogh so that when in later years, for example, his irises sold to somebody in Japan, or was it in Australia, for $56 million
right.
or something of the sort.
As a matter of fact,
if that didn't hurt you in a special way.
You know, I made almost a pilgrimage. You know, eventually it was purchased. The man bought it in the irises, which I love, that painting. He bought it in Australia, couldn't pay for it. And the Getty Museum bought it in California.
Oh, so it's in your backyard, is it?
That's right. Just about a month ago, I went up to take a look at it.
Uh-huh.
And I must say, Milt, I did a wonderful job in painting that.
Yes.
You know, I used to begin to think that way. I got a little nutty with that picture. See, I'm always telling people, look, there's a sharp line of demarcation between make-believe and reality. You know, the actor doesn't get lost in the part. The audience gets lost.
But you kept something of Vincent in you, did you?
Yeah.
I think
that movie kind of jolted me. I really, when it was over, I never wanted to see it. It took me some time before I ever saw the movie, because I felt so, I guess I felt so touched by this pathetic character.
I've got a problem. It's going to be a recurring problem tonight. I've got to break away from this.
Please, I'll be here when you get back.
I trust you will be. We're going to pause for these brief commercials.
This is Extension 720 on WGN Radio. Now again, Milt Rosenberg.
Kirk Douglas is our very special guest tonight. His new novel, Dance with the Devil, is just published by Random House. And you were listening to those commercials with some special interest, I thought.
No, I really am a little hurt. Because I'm sitting here, very anxious to be on your show, and I hear a commercial come on, and they talk about signing books at Crocs, I think, where is it?
It's at Water Tower.
Water Tower, and I thought, how nice. They're going to do a whole commercial because I'm going to be signing Dance with the Devil down at Crocs. And suddenly they're talking about Scott Turow. I mean, is that nice? I mean, I know he's a very successful author. I know he's a lawyer. I know he comes from Chicago, but what about, I'm an outside fellow. I'm here, and here they're giving an advertisement about his book.
I think you've got a very good case. You've got a very good case. And so it falls to me to make clear that tomorrow, in fact, you're doing two. Count them, two book signings.
That's right.
The first one, in fact, is at Marshall Field's from noon till 1 o'clock.
That's right.
That's the main Marshall Field store, I assume. And then at Crocs and Brentano's at Water Tower Place from 4:30 to 5:30.
Yes, and if Scott wants to join me, of course he's
a nice
more
kid,
than
I'm
welcome.
Sure he'd
and a damn good writer.
And a very good writer, indeed. Writer, indeed. You read his first novel.
Absolutely.
You read his second as well.
Yeah.
Do you do much reading in that genre?
Well, especially now. Yeah. Now that I'm trying to be a writer, you know, I've read Scott Turow, I read Doctorow, Tom Wolfe. I begin to read more novels, and I begin to find that I read them from a different point of view. I begin to try to see how they write, the point of view that they have, the verisimilitude. By the way, I never knew the meaning of that word. When I started to write Dance with the Devil, I kept getting things from Random House, more verisimilitude, and I was embarrassed to say that I had to look up the word. Well, you know, give more color, you know, more of an ambiance and stuff. But you see, I, Milt, don't mind writing a short declarative sentence. I get impatient if there's too much description. I find very often if I'm reading a book, and if there's too much description, I want to skip over the page and get to it. And I guess it's because of my training in the world of filmmaking that I see things as a scene, and I see character development through a scene and through dialogue. So I count on that more.
I want to read something to you.
Okay.
We're going to the movie business now, or rather to the art of cinema, or something in between. This is by a comment by Andrei Tarkovsky, who's supposed to be one of the great Soviet directors. I guess he left the Soviet Union some years ago and is making films in Europe and perhaps one or two in this country as well. This is his definition of what a film really is. He says, juxtaposing a person with an environment that is boundless, collating him with a countless number of people passing by close to him and far away, relating a person to the whole world. That is the meaning of cinema. Is it?
Well, if he says it is, I think, you know, I would
not... Sounds like a rather elevated intention.
I would not make it that that fancy. I think cinema, a book, is telling a story. Everything is telling a story. And that's why all through my movie making, I always thought they place too much emphasis on the director. It's the European auteur system that the Americans have quickly adopted, especially the Directors Guild. You see, if someone writes a very good story for me to make into a movie, I have a chance of making a good movie. I don't think that any director can take a bad story and make it into a good movie. So the most important thing has got to be the story. So I think I would place the greatest emphasis in movie making, which is a collaborative art. That's why, by the way, writing a novel is so it's such an ego trip, Milt, because you do it alone. I mean, I am an actor. What does an actor like to do? He wants to play all the parts. When I write Dance with the Devil, I play the women, the children, old ladies, young men, old men. I decide who gets laid, who doesn't. There's one man, Johnson. He was getting to me to be such a nudge. I murdered him. I mean, you're doing it by yourself. Then I write the book, and then you read it. It's a one-on-one. And if you don't like it, I have no... It's dangerous, you know. It's like working without a net, because I can't say, "Well, the director did this, or the producer did this, or whatever it is." You're doing it all on your own.
It just occurs to me: you now face that inevitable, attractive conflict of looking forward to this being made into a movie. I would bet that it's probably already been contracted, already been sold.
No. Well, to begin with, you know, let me assure you that when I'm writing, it's the last thing I think of. That would destroy what I'm trying to do if I thought of what would make this a good movie.
But it is a very cinematic story. I can see this turning into a fine film in the right hands with the right actors.
There's been interest in it. As a matter of fact, my son Peter said, "Gee, he thinks." I said, "Dad, I think it should be like a 4 or 6 hour television series because it covers so much time." And he said, "I think Eric, my youngest son, should play the young Dennison. Then Michael should play the middle part that has all the sexy scenes, and I should play the older part." So I said, "Well,
makes sense."
Yes, but I said, "Peter, that's a great idea. You could probably get Eric and you could get me, but could you afford Michael? I mean, you'll have a problem."
Doesn't he give cut rates to his old man?
I don't know. We haven't put that to the test yet.
I promised myself I wouldn't ask any of the cliché questions one usually puts to famous actors, but I can't really resist this one. When you think back on the films you've done, we've mentioned one or two that you do value. Which others are you proudest of? For that matter, which ones could you stand to really see again?
Well, I'll tell you. As a matter of fact, the first movie, I've forgotten about that one. Strange Love of Martha Ivers, I thought it was a good movie.
The Barbara Stanwyck and Van Heflin.
That's right.
Well. Yeah.
I thought Letter to Three Wives is a good movie. I thought Champion, which I suppose made me a star, was a very, very interesting movie, which holds up very well. I thought working with Willie Wilder on Detective Story, Ace in the Hole, Bad and the Beautiful, Lust for Life. Well, I start to run out of movies that I like. That's about, there may be a few. I think that 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, for that kind of a movie, was a charming movie. And a good Western was Gunfight at the OK Corral. There are a few.
It was a fine
Western.
But
that's not 80. I made around 80.
Paths of Glory is one that...
How could I have forgotten
You didn't
that
mention I'm surprised
Paths
you didn't
of,
mention
Oh,
it.
No. Paths of Glory,
it's a Kubrick,
I think it's a
Kubrick directed that.
That's right. Yeah. That's a great movie. It says something important in an interesting way. You know, it's a great anti-war movie. I'm proud of that one because I had a tough time, you know, getting the nobody wanted to make the movie, getting the financing to make that movie.
But you produced it as well, did you?
Yes, that was my company. Bryna.
I didn't realize that the Brynner company you're calling.
Brynner. That's
Brynner, which
that's
is your
my
mother's
name.
I know.
You know, you've heard the story of why I call it the Brynner company. Well, let me tell it to you again, even if you heard it, because I love this story. You know,
I just know its name for your mother. I don't know the story.
Well, my mother is a nice, literate, Jewish lady who can't read or write. You know, she's the kind, if I'm at the beginning when I started my Hollywood career, hello, Ma, I call on the phone, hello, hello, my son. And Ma, you know, I just signed a $1 million contract. Yes, she says, my son, but you know, you look thin in the last movie. I mean, she doesn't know anything about it. So once I came home and my mother had her old friends around her and she's saying, oh, my son, she says, look at my son. His name, she says, in lights. And I'm, you know, and all her old cronies are nodding and smiling at me, and I felt a little embarrassed. And she kept saying, America, such a wonderful land. And I said, look, Ma, America, such a wonderful land. I'll put your name in lights. And she laughs, and it was only within 1 year I had named my company Bryna. I took my mother to New York in a big limousine. We went down Times Square, and I said, you see, Ma, that big sign, seeing lights? That name that I taught you how to write, B-R-Y-N-A. Mm. Bryna presents Spartacus. And my mother said, yeah, America, such a wonderful land.
Is she still with us?
No. No, both my mother and father have died quite some time ago.
Yeah.
But they, I mean, they both lived to see me attain some recognition.
And they came from a very deprived and a very hard background, and for that matter, your own early life, as I read about it in the early chapters of that autobiography of yours that appeared last year, The Ragman's Son, your early life was a life of considerable deprivation.
Yeah, but it's a corny story. It's a typical American story. From the depths of poverty, he rose to become champion. That was what the announcer said in the movie Champion. That's what he said about the champion. I always laughed about that. And I think it's you know, it's a typical American story. My autobiography, I thought, in a sense, was a tribute to our way of life, and that is that within one generation, you can have two illiterate people come to this country from Russia and have a son who has a chance to get a college education, go into the field of work that he wants to do, and gain some recognition. By no means do I mean that anybody can do it, but what this country does do is it gives you a chance. If they hadn't caught the boat, I don't know what would have happened to me.
Great Hollywood acting, lots of people have said, wasn't just a matter of good actor skills. There was a kind of persisting persona across roles which had tremendous identity and significance. Bette Davis was always a fine actress, and she varied appropriately from role to role, but there was a sort of a persisting Bette Davis element in everything that she did. The same is certainly true of Kirk Douglas. And I don't know how one describes that Douglas quality. Intensity is an easy word. I've used it already once or twice tonight. A kind of a fierceness, a kind of
hunger.
Is that
possibly?
Yeah. I was about to ask you what you think the Douglas persona is.
A hunger for something.
Mm-hmm.
A hunger for something that you want to express. A need to fulfill something within yourself. It's like perhaps feeling an emptiness about something that makes you angry, and you feel a need to do something to express it.
You think that infuses most of the roles that you play?
Well,
or that's
you
what
know,
you,
you
to
want
those
to
roles.
Generalize, I suppose, you know, just as you say, you know, everybody, Brando, for example, has a wonderful style that I've always loved. I used to tell my youngest son, Eric, I say, Eric, watch Brando in a film. He knows how to do nothing. He knows how important it is to do nothing. He will do nothing. He will mumble. You won't hear him. And then suddenly he'll have one moment that just electrifies. And it's made the more sharper because of the contrast of being so, so low-key before that. You see, he dares to do nothing. I've said that to Michael. Michael, when he had to, took the part in one... Streets of San Francisco. He said, gee, Dad, he said, you know, I don't know. He says, I don't have anything to do in it. I said, Michael, take it, because I don't know anybody who can do nothing better than you. And it's true. Michael has a quality much better than I have of being able to do absolutely nothing and just watch, observe, and look. And that's what makes you interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Very often, you know, a good actor, a star, you will watch, somebody else may be talking, but suddenly you find your eye go to him, the fellow who's listening. There's something about him that draws your eye to him. It's a great quality.
Here's a thought. the great mimics, Frank Gorshin was one, there are a few others around, they're going to have trouble in a few years, or their successors will have trouble. You can't really do good mimicry and good imitation of the new crop of Hollywood stars. Whereas, in the repertoire of all of the great mimics, there's always a Kirk Douglas, there's always a Burt Lancaster, and so on. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we think that now. Maybe, you know, after all, we've been around for a few years, but if you want to see, of course it's true, Frank Gorshin does the best imitation. But someday you ought to see my four sons.
I read about that.
Doing an imitation of me all at the same time. That's something to see.
But it seems to me that this fact that you were imitable, though always in caricature, that Lancaster is, that Cary Grant
in the mill,
was,
all of us.
That points to that quality of special persona.
Yeah, but also because we all worked so much more. Bert and I once talked about this. We were doing three movies a year, starring in three movies a year, sometimes mm-hmm. four. Well, most actors today don't do that. I mean, sometimes they might do one or two, and then they don't do one for mm-hmm. a year or so. You know, we kept working. You know, you're an actor, you act. So, within my span of time, and I still will be doing a few more movies, that I've done almost 80 movies, it's an awful lot of movies, perhaps too much. As I look back on it now, I think a lot of it was a compulsion to work that now writing a book has eradicated. But actors in the past worked much more often, going way back to Humphrey Bogart, you know, or Eddie Robinson, or Errol Flynn. They worked more, and I think that perhaps, you saw them more often on the screen. Now, I think the trend is to look more toward a blockbuster. You know, instead of trying to make one good movie and after another good movie, they want to make that blockbuster, that big killer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been bad.
It's interesting to me to hear that you have a number of additional films you want to do. You are now, what, 74?
72. Please, Mill, don't make me an old man. I'm a young man of 72.
A young man of 72. You do write rather evocatively in one of the last chapters of The Ragman's Son about your 70th birthday in London and how you tried to avoid it and just sequester yourself with your wife in a hotel.
Oh, God, that was awful. And Eric came in and made such... He had me all over town. He had me in... Oh, that, I tell you, that was so funny. I didn't
Dragged you to a dinner party with Prince Andrew and his new
That's
wife.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it was... I mean, I tell you, and I was so set. I said, honey, I said to my wife, boy, I just want to stay home. Let's have a drink. And suddenly Eric, I mean, my youngest son is really, he's a character. I thought he was in Paris. Mm-hmm. Suddenly he arrives to surprise me. He'd arrange his whole dinner party, and it was all over town. People are singing happy birthday. I'm trying to forget. That was funny.
We've got to pause once again for a quick batch of commercials. We will be on to the phones in about 15 minutes, and we're opening the lines right now. The number is, of course, 591-7200, 591-7200. And if you're in Hollywood and the signal is getting over the Rockies, as it rarely but sometimes does, depending upon freaks in the ionosphere or freakish effects in the ionosphere, then the area code is 312. And that, indeed, it's 312 for anybody who's out of our own immediate area. 312-591-7200. We try to give long-distance calls priority. And we'll be right back to Kirk Douglas, author of Dance with the Devil, just published by Random House, after these words.
From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Now back to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Kirk Douglas, our guest tonight. The new novel, Dance with the Devil, is really excellent reading. Sidney Sheldon is one of the people who commends it, and he should know. It's very much of that quality. A page-turner that you really don't put down. This did keep me up last night till about 2 or 2.30 in the morning. And still I hadn't finished it. I had to wait until today, and I turned to it directly.
Well,
after,
I hear that, Mel. I'm disappointed that it didn't keep you up long enough to finish it, but anyhow, I'm glad that you liked it, Mel.
But I think I must have dreamed about it. I think it filtered through some rich dream work that I did last night. A word or two before we go to the phones on 591-7200. And if you've been trying to reach us, continue to try. I see we've cleared one or two lines, though they may shortly be taken again. great presidents that, or at least interesting presidents that have known you, you've known a number, and it turns out, this, again, I never really knew until looking at the Ragman's Son, that you've had a considerable role overseas representing this country.
That's right. Well, I've done that for about 25 years. It's for that that I got the Medal of Freedom that I'm very proud of. It's the highest civilian award that can, you know, that's granted. And in a sense, what I was doing was telling them the Ragman's Son story. Mm-hmm. How best to tell people in foreign countries what America is about than to tell them about me, myself, my background, where I came from, who I am. And that's the best way I thought I could find of telling them what our country's about. So I've done that in probably 40 countries around the world over a long period of time.
You're also a Chevalier d'honneur for France. What did
you
do for
that? Well, I'm now the officier, if you must know. That's the next
highest rank.
Highest rank. Yeah, I've done a lot of things for France. You know, I met my wife in Paris when I went to France to do a movie in French.
What film was that?
Act of Love. With Tola Litvak.
Uh-huh.
And it was an interesting story. And I've done quite a few things with France. I've been president of the jury. I've you know, officiated at their Césars, which is their Oscar ceremony.
I see. Yeah.
And I've helped President Giscard d'Estaing when he gave the Saint Lumière gift to the White House. I've done quite a few things because. And obviously, my wife, coming from France, I've been quite active there. And in my book, my autobiography, mm-hmm. was very successful. It pleased me in France. It was number one in France, so that pleased me. So I've had quite a long relationship with France.
I didn't know you had done films in the French language. You are francophone, then, are you? Pretty comfortable in the language?
Yes, I can speak French quite well. Yeah. I get by in German. I get by in Italian. But a lot of that, Milt, was because my wife mm-hmm. speaks all the languages. And I used to be so annoyed. You know, I couldn't stand going into a country and she's doing it all. So I would at least learn enough to get by. And yes.
591-7200 is our number, and we will be onto the phones shortly. You're doing another novel.
I'm working on another novel.
Your appetite has been whetted, and
I love it. I think it's hard work. It's mm-hmm. really hard work, but it's wonderful. And you know, they say, and it's not lonely work. I've heard that, you know, being a writer is lonely. But it's not lonely because you're with all these characters that you're creating. And as you keep writing, these characters become more definitely defined. They become more enriched. And they really become people. And very often when you're writing a scene, you have an idea about how the scene should go. And suddenly you find the scene going in a different direction. It's as if they actually take on a life of their own. And that's exciting.
Cliche question number two, unavoidable, because you are a Hollywood veteran and still very much involved in the Hollywood scene and in the American film industry. The great achievements of the Douglas boys, to the contrary, notwithstanding, all in all, how do you evaluate contemporary Hollywood production as compared to what we were getting in the years, say, immediately after the war?
Well, of course, I preferred movies of a few years back, for the most part. I think there are a lot of good movies that are made now, but I think there's too much of a trend now to rely on special effects, to rely on excessive violence, mm-hmm. To rely on, and some people may think this is strange coming from me, excessive sex. I use sex in my novels, but I think it has to be used for a reason, not just to have it there gratuitously. So I think you don't get the story, for example, to me, a great movie is Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
A lovely story, lovely character relationships. And I picked that because that's really an old movie. That movie was made before I ever came to Hollywood. And yet, when you see it now, it still holds up. It's a good movie. It's based on characters, relationships, a wonderful story of love, friendship between men, and it's a wonderful story. So that's what I miss. I would like, and I think, though, it'll be a trend. There'll be more movies like that coming back.
But what about the change in the production system? Didn't the existence of the great stable studios have something to do with the making of films of that sort.
Well, of course, that whole thing, Milt, has changed completely.
I know. Yeah.
You see, movies were started mostly by Jews because there was a void. At the very beginning of movie making, that was considered a cheap Nickelodeon, a cheap occupation. Not many people wanted to go into it. And many Jewish people went into it and, in a sense, almost tried to fulfill their dreams of what America's like.
The nastiest character in your book calls it a kike business, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
He's a vile, rich man.
That's right. That's what it was thought of. Of course, yeah. Now you have a Japanese company buying a studio. You have an Australian buys a studio. You have a soft drink company buying. So it's quite different. It's a whole different atmosphere now. I don't think that's going to last long. See, I think that people who go in just as purely as businessmen... and there's an economic side. Of course, it's all based on economics. But if they go in purely as that, they won't last long. Because I think somehow, even the studio heads, even those tough moguls of years gone by, had a certain love for films that I think you have to have.
I was interested in your reference to Casablanca as exemplifying what you take to be a great and classic film. And I wonder what else would be on your list of the top 10 of all time. Just as that British journal brings out such a list every so often.
Well, I don't know. I would certainly have to say that David Lean made several.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lawrence of Arabia. You know, Dr. Zhivago. There have been a lot of good movies made over the years.
Would you put Citizen Kane on your list?
Oh, yes.
The greatest?
Yeah, Citizen Kane, I think, was a great movie. And Orson Welles was, to me, such a pathetic character. I knew Orson Welles, because he had such a great talent that he just abused. And I think that's sinful. I really think it's sinful, because when you have a talent like that, it's almost like it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the world. You have no right to dissipate it, you know? Citizen Kane was, of course, a marvelous.
Herman Mankiewicz got off a line once, which I encountered recently, about Welles there, but for the grace of God goes God.
That's right, I heard that. That's wonderful. He's the only man that ever sent me roses. We were in Italy. We had a date for dinner. We were in Rome. And he couldn't make it. So he sent me 24 roses. I always thought that was a strange
thing. Who are some of your favorite people? Quite apart from whether they did great films or not. But in the Hollywood world, who were your best friends?
Well, I've been kind of a loner. Of course, I've done about 6-7 movies with Burt Lancaster, so I know him quite well. And I like him. I like Burt. Burt loves music. He's a great opera lover. See, a lot of these people are quite different than what the public think they are.
That last one where the two of you get out of prison and decide...
Tough Guys.
Tough Guys. That's wonderful
funny.
Stuff.
We kind of kidded ourselves a little bit. I enjoyed that movie. I liked that. And Burt, as a matter of fact, I also did a play with Burt. A few years back, we did Boys in Autumn, which was Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn about 50 years later.
Oh, how wonderful. I've
they
never
meet
heard
each other.
Really?
Yeah, we did it for 6 weeks in San Francisco. We never did anything more with it. We wanted to do something on the stage. And just a two-character play. A great premise. Great. As a matter of fact, my son, Peter, has an option on it now. He wants to do something with it.
We will pause and... take care of another batch of commercials, and then it's time for telephones. And so, if you're trying to reach us at the moment, I know you're not succeeding because all the lines are taken, but do continue to try, and especially call again directly after we've finished with some prior caller. The number is 591-7200, 591-7200, onto the phones after these words.
This is WGN Radio Chicago. You're listening to Extension 720. Here again, your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Kirk Douglas, whose new novel, Dance with the Devil, is just published, and who will appear at two book signings tomorrow. Let's mention those again. One at Marshall Field's, that's from noon till 1 o'clock, and then later in the afternoon at Crocs and Brentano's, the Water Tower Place store, that from 4:30 till 5:30. 591-7200 is our number, and we'll go directly to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi. Kirk?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed The Ragman Son, and I'm looking forward to reading your new novel. But I had a question mainly about tough guys. First of all, I'm 25 years old, and I was just hot looking at you on the screen. You just are just, I mean, you just do something to people. And I just wanted to know, you seem like an excellent athlete, and do you still work out? Do you train, or what are you into?
Absolutely. I think that the creative process is the most exhausting thing in the world. I've worked in steel mills. There's nothing that takes as much energy as acting or things like that. So I work out every day. I have a system of working out for 15 minutes every day.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. You look in awfully good shape.
Thank you.
What do you do to stay so trim?
Well, of course, by what I ate today, you would say, how am I trim, because I was starving when I arrived in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But I try to watch my diet, and I don't try to go overboard, but I'm active. I play tennis, I swim, I play golf, and I try to work out.
Mm-hmm. Literally every day?
Every day.
Put in an hour or more?
15
without
minutes.
Without fail?
15 minutes, that's it.
Uh-huh. Just 15?
That's right. I think people try to work out too much. My feeling, like in most things, I think less is more in acting. A lot of things in life. And I think that people overdo. They try to work out for 2 hours. But I think I use a series of weights, calisthenics. I go from one exercise. I get my aerobics by going from one exercise to the other.
Mm-hmm.
I do it for 15 minutes. Then I might play some golf that day or whatever it is. And walking. I'm not in favor of running. I think running, I've seen Michael. He got to the point where he's running almost 28 miles in one day. And one day I said, Michael, how's the running? No, he said, and he rubbed his knees. Yeah, because you can't take all that. And he hurt his knees and he stopped running. So I think walking is much better than running. But then I'm not an expert on these things. This is just my own personal feeling.
Sounds very wise. Back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Rosenberg. I'd like to say how much I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And my question for Kirk is him and Burt Lancaster planning on doing a sequel to Tough Guys? Or is there anything in the work for him?
Well, you know, people have asked me quite a few times, are we going to do a sequel to Tough Guys? We enjoy doing Tough Guys. There's no plan to do a sequel to that. And Bert has been doing quite a bit of work in some movies in Europe. I see him quite often. We play golf now and then. And I've known him for about 40 years.
One other question. Do you plan on doing any work with your son, Michael, or any of your other sons?
Yes, Michael and I are planning to do a movie together. We've been working on something for a couple of years. I think we've got a project now. It's a circus theme that I think might work well. And I'm also planning to do another movie with my son, Eric, who's my youngest son. He's right in Israel now, making a movie. So right now, I love the idea of trying to do a movie with all my sons.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Good night.
You know, in both your autobiography, The Ragman Son, and in the new novel, Dance with the Devil, occasional Yiddish words appear, quite appropriately. I guess you are fairly comfortable in and familiar with that language. So you'll understand that it sounds to me as if when it comes to you and your four sons, you have naches von Kindel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Naches, gratification from your children is one of the nicest things that can happen to anyone, because bringing up kids is the toughest job in the world, because it doesn't matter. You may think you're doing everything right, and the kids, somehow it doesn't work out. And I think if it does work out, a lot of it is just luck. So I feel that I've had quite a bit of nachas for my kids.
Your kids, are two of them from your first wife and two from your
second?
That's
right.
Yeah. And there is this question of whether they're Jewish or not. Legally or Talmudically, they're not. Unless they choose to become so.
You know, I've explained that. I once said to Michael, Michael, what are you? He said, I'm Jewish. I said, well, Michael, why would you say that? I said, you know, your mother is Episcopalian, and according to the Jewish laws, what you are is determined by the mother, because they're never sure who the father is, but they know who the mother is. So I said, so why would you say that? He thought a while, and he said, well, because I feel that I'm Jewish. And I thought, you know, that's the way almost any form of religion should be. I think that kids are inculcated too early in life in religion. It should be a personal choice eventually. And that's the way I brought my kids up. My kids can be whatever they want to be and whatever they think satisfies their needs.
You say, again, I'm referring to The Ragman Son, which I've just been working through today. I hadn't read it when it first appeared, though I knew that it was much commended, and I intend, having just read Dance with the Devil, to now indulge myself and really enjoy this autobiography, probably over this weekend. But you do say towards the end, because I jumped forward towards the end, that following a kind of a universal law, as you grow somewhat older, you find your interest in religion increases.
Yes. Well, I think what happens by that is, and I hate to use the word, but I think as you get older, a certain spirituality, a need for that, comes into play in your relationship with your wife, in your relationship with friends. You know, suddenly friendships become so much more meaningful. You realize how during the years you take friendships for granted. A relationship, my wife and I have been married for 36 years. And there's suddenly another type of beauty comes into your life that has a spiritual side to it that is not based on any formalized type of religion. It doesn't matter whether you're Jewish, Catholic, Protestant. But the spiritual side I relate to with a religion.
Does it affect your reading, your... For that matter, even the use of your time? Have you turned back to religion in any formal sense or in any intellectual sense? Or is it just a matter of
the development
of a personal interest that deepen in a kind of spiritual direction?
I don't think it's in Milton any formalized sense. For example, even though I've been brought up in an Orthodox Jewish religion, I don't adhere to the orthodoxy of it. But there's yet one thing, for example... Yom Kippur comes along once a year. I may not even go to the synagogue, but I find that I always fast.
I don't eat
or drink for 24 hours. I have even worked on those days. I've been making a picture. And while I'm making a picture, nobody knows that I'm not eating or drinking on that day. Somehow, that has always stuck with me.
Yeah.
And I use that element, by the way, I use that thought, and I guess... You see, so many thoughts that come to your mind when you're writing a novel are subconscious, because I use that thought in Dance with the Devil.
Yeah, I recognize that.
Yeah.
let's go back to the phones. Here's the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Douglas.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I just want to say I think you're a truly genuine, nice man, and I've seen you on several interviews, and you seem like a really nice guy.
Well, thank you.
And the question that I was wondering, compared to the days when you were working, you know, when most of the great Hollywood actors were in their heyday, who do you consider today to be a good or a great actor of today?
Well, the first name that comes to my mind, strangely enough, seems to be Michael Douglas.
That's what I thought.
No, I do. I think that, I sincerely think that my son Michael is a fine actor because he plays the part. I've watched how he played the role of Gordon Gekko in Wall Street, and compare that with the way he played the role in War of the Roses. You know, he dares to play it correctly. I mean, the way he was playing that scene with Kathleen Turner, you understood why Kathleen Turner wanted to punch him right in the face. I think Michael is a fine actor. I think Jack Nicholson is a fine actor. I think Tom Cruise, of the young actors, is an excellent actor. I don't know Tom Cruise. I have never met him. I've always wanted to tell him that. I've seen him. I've always wanted to work with him. I saw the wonderful job that he did with Paul Newman in the...
it was the Hustler
Color
sequel.
Money.
Color of Money. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought he was wonderful with Dustin Hoffman and Rain Man. He was wonderful. He's a fine young actor. And there's a lot of them that I don't know, but that's... couple that come to mind.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you,
sir. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I must tell you a quick story. I was saying to you earlier off the air that I've interviewed a few famous female actors, actresses from Hollywood, but never one of the great film male stars. But I was wrong. I just remembered one of them was John Carradine. He wasn't one of the great matinee idols, but
a
wonderfully interesting character actor. This was many years ago, and he was here, and I asked him that cliche question, who are the great actors today? And he pulled himself up into his Shakespearean heights, and he said, "There are none except myself."
Barrymore.
And then, exactly. Even did a Barrymore snorter there. Except myself. And then he went on to say, though actually one or two of my sons are doing rather well. What you were just saying reminds me of the same reaction. Though I quite agree with you about your son.
Yeah, his son's Keith Carradine. He's a fine actor. Yeah. He's a good actor, too.
591-7200, the number, and on to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Douglas.
Yes, sir.
I've been a lifelong fan of yours for 40 years.
Thank you.
And I really enjoy your work. But what I want to ask you, you made a movie in 1957, Paths to Glory,
yes,
with Stanley Kubrick.
That's right.
And I've never been able to get that movie on video. And I think that was one of your greatest movies you ever made.
It's Paths of Glory.
Yeah. Paths of Glory.
Paths of Glory. I agree with you. We were talking about that a little while ago. It's a wonderful movie. I don't know why you can't get it. You know, I don't control movies that I make, even within my own production company. I don't control the distribution of it. So sometimes I'm perplexed, too, the way they handle the distribution of a film, because that is a great classic, and I'm sure it will be, if it's not available on video now, it soon will be, because you can't keep that film down.
It's set in the First World War.
Oh, it's wonderful.
The French army.
That's right. Even close to it is All Quiet on the Western Front, the German perspective.
But that's right.
And to this day, I can still remember your performance in there and how you had it was signed the lieutenant to assassinate the three cowards.
That's right. That was quite a touching movie, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
And the only other movie, just briefly, that I really, really stuck in my mind is when you played a down-and-out reporter and there was a poor fellow excavating in New Mexico for
that's the movie that had two titles. It was originally called Ace in the Hole, and then it also was called The Big Carnival. That was Billy Wilder.
That was
a very powerful movie.
It was.
You think so?
The one line that you said in there that stuck in my mind is you never mistrust a man that wears a belt and suspenders.
That's right.
Good writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
A pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call, sir.
Okay.
We pause to take care of some commercials and then directly back. If you've been trying to reach us, I see at the moment one line available. No, two available. And so keep trying. And if you don't succeed at first, try and try again. 591-7200. We return after this.
This is Extension 720 on WGN Radio. Now again, Milt Rosenberg.
And now again, Kirk Douglas. It is not a matter of total surprise that our lines are more or less jammed and everybody wants to talk to you.
Well, I'm delighted.
But for those who are trying to reach us and not succeeding, do continue to try. There is a fairly rapid turnover, and call again, especially after we say goodnight to somebody else. Here is the next caller coming up. Good evening.
Good evening. Hi, Kirk. I've been such a longtime fan, enjoyed your work for just tremendously.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is in reference to an appearance you made aboard the USS Midway, the carrier. My husband was aboard as a young lieutenant, and he so enjoyed your visit that time, almost 40 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And he
that was off Europe, in Europe, wasn't it?
Exactly, in the Med.
That's right, Mediterranean. I remember that.
Do you?
And certainly.
He certainly always enjoyed telling us about how you came and sat in the junior officer's wardroom right with them, and they just loved it so much. And we're going to Washington in October for a reunion, and I thought it would be great fun to be able to say that I spoke with you tonight.
Well, please say hello for me. I remember that trip. It was at that time, I think, that I met my wife. She wasn't my wife then, but I got married soon after that.
Well, he made reference to that because we read about it after that.
That's right.
So this is a very great joy for us, and thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Good night, ma'am. Thank you for the call. You are a Navy man yourself. During the war, you were in the Navy, weren't
you? Yes, I was in anti-submarine warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to read my autobiography carefully, you'll find about my experiences during the war, my whole attitude about that. It's very funny. I figured out that the government would have saved millions of dollars if they kept me out of the war.
Mm-hmm. Were you in combat?
Yeah, in the Pacific. I was in the Atlantic and the Pacific. But a lot of funny things happened that I wrote about in that.
It was on shipboard, things were usually snafu'd, were they?
That's right.
Yeah.
All a bunch of, we were such a small ship, young officers, mm-hmm. you know. It was amazing.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. Mr. Douglas, I'd like to ask you if you have an opinion about the biographies of film stars that are published after the film stars are dead. I'm referring to the one about Errol Flynn, in which everybody learned that he was a Nazi, and the one about Cary Grant, in which everybody learned that he was a homosexual.
Both of those written by the same man, right. Charles Higham, I believe.
And one of the few times, or probably the only time, Milt, that I haven't listened to your show all the way through.
Which one?
The one where you had that biographer on, and he was talking about Errol Flynn and Cary Grant, telling me all the intimate details that I could have cared less about.
He really startled me with that Errol Flynn business.
Yeah.
He's quite convinced that Flynn was a conscious agent of the Nazis.
Well, you know, those are myths. I've heard about that. But, you know, I don't believe most of the things, the gossip that you hear, and it's not important to me. And I think it's unfair to have some, to write a story. I mean, I know Cary Grant very well. I don't know. I've known Cary Grant over the years with some of the most beautiful women I've ever known. I don't know anything about his homosexuality. And Errol Flynn, I met him when I first came to Hollywood. I just do agree with you that I think it's unfair for someone to write a book about someone and make accusations like that when that person is not alive to defend himself. I think that's unfair.
I do, too, and what saddens me is that I want to remember, I mean, I don't mean to speak of you like you're dead, because I know that you have many years to go, but I want to remember you as Spartacus and as Doc Holliday and as Vincent Van Gogh, and I don't want to know the intimate details, which may or may not be true, that some writer digs up, you know.
Well, listen, when I go, no matter what someone else might write about me, I want you to keep thinking of me as Spartacus and all of those characters.
Well, the fact is, though, you've beaten those biographers to the punch because your autobiography is a quite revealing document.
That's right. It's very revealing. And that's one of the reasons, Milt, that I wrote it. I wanted to, you know, and a lot of things in my autobiography that people criticize, you know, unfavorably. But I wanted to be as honest as I could. I wanted to make my statement of who I think I am for my family, for my friends, and for the world, for that matter. And then anybody else can take a pot shot at me. It's a free country. You have free speech, and people can say what they think.
Ma'am, thank you for an interesting question.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Good night. And let us dash on to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Kirk.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm a big fan of yours, and I think that Spartacus is one of your best films.
I enjoyed that, yes.
Yes, excellent. I was wondering what it was like working with Stanley Kubrick on that film in Paths of Glory, and also Laurence Olivier.
Well, of course, Spartacus was a delight.
Yes.
I mean, every day to come to the set and to watch Olivier, Lawton, Ustinov, Gene Simmons was really something. And, of course, Kubrick, I think, is a great director. In my autobiography, I have some harsh words to say about him as a person, but that has nothing to do with his talent as a director. He's an extremely talented director, and in the two movies that I worked with him, Paths of Glory, Spartacus, I think it shows the great talent that he has, because I think they're both great movies.
I agree. When you worked in Devil's Disciple with Olivier, what was it like working with Olivier at that time?
Well, Olivier was always someone that, you know, you felt like a little kid, you know, a sandlot baseball player watching a major leaguer. You know, he was terrific, but he was really a nice guy. He was helpful. I remember asking him a couple of suggestions while I was doing Spartacus, and he was very helpful in a very modest way. I loved the guy. He was wonderful.
Fantastic. Is there any role that you haven't tackled that you might want to? I know you want to work with your sons, of course, but is there anything that you feel not fulfilled in doing in Hollywood?
Well, I always wanted to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, I know.
But Jack Nicholson did a pretty good job of it.
He sure did.
You did that on stage.
Yes, I did it on stage, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, you controlled the rights?
I owned the book, yeah. I owned it. I was partners in the production.
Yeah. Why didn't you cast yourself in the film then?
Well, I wanted to when I was doing it for 10 years, but when I gave it over to my son, I gave him all the controls, and they had a right to do with it, and as rightly they should. And obviously, the results show that they did the right thing. They made a hell of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
That reminds me of another rather recent thing of yours, which is set also in an institution, not in an institution for the supposedly mentally disturbed, but rather for the aged. That television film, Amos, which is very touching, and also led to considerable social commitment on your part, too.
That's right. I went to, as a matter of fact, I wrote an editorial in the New York Times, and then I went to Washington and appeared with Claude Pepper's committee for a congressional hearing on elderly abuse. And I'm proud of that movie. My son, Peter, produced that movie, as he did Inherit the Wind. I've enjoyed doing several movies on TV, and I will probably do another one. One of the reasons I like doing a movie on TV, very often you can take a subject that's difficult to do as a theatrical movie, but you have a chance to do it on TV, and you can deal with something like Amos. I enjoy that.
It's first-rate stuff. Here's the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Douglas.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. You've been a favorite of mine ever since The Champion.
Thank you.
And one of my favorite movies of yours was Spartacus. And I have wondered, and also Paths of Glory, a great favorite. I wondered, since Adolf Manju was a witness for the government against the Hollywood Ten, and since I know that you later did hire Dalton Trumbo to write Spartacus, I just wondered, how did you feel being in that movie with him?
Well, I'm quite impressed with your knowledge of what was going on at that time.
I'm old.
But that's, one thing has nothing to do with the other.
I agree.
For example, John Wayne and I were antipodal in so many things. We didn't see eye to eye, and yet we worked in four movies together. Adolf Manju was quite a different person than I was. But nevertheless, for example, in Paths of Glory, I thought he was brilliant.
Excellent.
So I just thought of him as an actor and not as a friend.
Did you have any choice in his being in that part or not? Or was it chosen by Kubrick?
Well, we mutually agreed. I thought he would be perfect for it. We all did, and he was.
Ah, he certainly was. And while I'm at it, while I'm being political, why don't you put in a good word for NEA? National Endowment for the Arts.
Well, that brings up such a big... There's a whole big article, I think, it's in Time magazine on that. And that's a big, big... that's something that Milt and I are going to have to take another two-hour session just to deal with NEA alone.
Right. I love your performances.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
And we'll pause for some lesser but necessary performances, and then we'll be directly back to Kirk Douglas and your calls for him on 591-7200.
From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Now back to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And directly back to Kirk Douglas. Did I say that the new novel by Kirk Douglas, Dance with the Devil, is readily available? It's published by Random House. Hey, has this made the New York Times top 15 list yet?
It's just come out. This is the first, I think this is the first week that they ascertain whatever.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So we'll know.
Remember, you heard it here first. It will be on the list in 2 weeks at the latest, if not next week.
Thank you.
And it will go to probably first position within a month.
This is your guarantee?
No, it's my prediction.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It'll certainly be among the top three within a month.
Oh, I appreciate it.
That's my guarantee.
Appreciate your point of view. Thank you.
And I'll check it out. 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello, Dr. Rosenberg.
Yes, sir.
It's a pleasure to be able to get through to you. I'm an avid listener. I want to quickly comment that I enjoy your use of the English language, first of all, before my question.
That's very kind, sir.
You're very articulate. Mr. Douglas, you're a real actor.
He's pretty articulate, too.
All your movies.
He's pretty articulate, too.
I'm not articulate.
Oh, God, you are.
Oh, you are, too.
Right, thank you.
My question is, how was it working with John Wayne? In Harm's Way comes to mind, War Wagon. How were your experiences with
I tell you, what I liked about John Wayne, he was a professional. He was always the first one on, he was never late. He was the first one on the set. He did his job. I think John Wayne would have been much more effective if he didn't become the boss. See, very often when you have your own production, there's a danger. See, John Wayne, if you look at his work, in my opinion, you'll find that when he was working with people like Ford or Hawks, he did his best work when he had a strong director. Mm-hmm. But when he had a director that he could push around, he sort of imitated his style too much. But I enjoyed working with John Wayne, and he was really a tremendous a legend.
Or when he became his own director, Green Berets, was that the name of the thing about the Green Berets?
The Alamo.
No, the one about the Green Berets in Vietnam.
The Green Berets.
Yeah, he starred in it, and I think he directed it himself.
Did he direct that? I know he directed the one, remember, the Alamo.
Oh, yeah? Well, he wasn't much of a director, is the point I was going to make.
No.
There is a wonderful anecdote, which I happened to stumble upon in your autobiography, The Ragman's Son, right after you made Lust for Life.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was when I had just made Lust for Life, and there was a showing of it, a preview showing to a select audience, and Wayne was there, and then we had a little party after that, and he had a drink in his hand. He was mumbling and finally motioned to me, and we went out on the porch, and he was so angry with me. Gosh, how did I dare play such a weakling, a sniveling character? And I said, well, John, I'm an actor. I want to play an interesting part. But no, he was very upset because he felt that we should play real macho characters. But I liked Wayne. And I was very touched that not too long ago, his son Michael said to me, you know, my father loved you. It almost jolted me because I never thought of him having any, you know, really a warm affection for me because we were very different politically and all that. But that's why, like someone else who called earlier, Milt, there's a difference, you know. People have different political opinions, but you have to adjust to them and make your appraisal of them as an actor, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing.
Sir, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice
Keep
contribution.
Up the good work.
Thank you.
Good night, and let's go to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kirk.
Yes, sir.
I've been a longtime fan of yours.
Thank you.
Hearing you tonight and talking about your son, Michael, it sounds like you've got a really nice relationship with him, and I really have a lot of respect for that. And it made me think of a question that kind of relates to you and your son. Kind of similar to the way the baseball players' salaries have kind of skyrocketed, it seems like actors and actresses are being paid exorbitantly compared to what you used to make when you sort of broke in. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think anybody should get as much as they can. Believe me, nobody takes a gun to the head of a studio and says, you must pay this actor this amount of money. If they are paying Michael or Stallone or any of those people a high sum of money, it's because they think they're worth it. Otherwise, they wouldn't pay it. And obviously, you know, over the years, prices have gone up with inflation and all that. And I think a person should get what they deserve to get. I feel the same way in the sports world. I mean, an athlete is entitled to ask for as much as he thinks he's worth. The boss can say, no, I'm sorry, I don't think you're worth that, and refuse to pay him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody ever... Mm. See, most people forget how much the studios make. You know, we forget the millions and millions that a studio makes. But always what is publicized is the salary that an actor gets. I mean, very few people know that several heads of the studio last year one did about $34 million, another took in $40 million in their stock options and so on. Well, people forget that. But if somebody gets $10 million or $15 million in salary, that's more publicized. I think actors should get as much as they can get.
We should all get as much as we can.
That's
get.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
And let's go to this one. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to put in a plug for my favorite Kirk Douglas movie, and although it's not strictly Kirk Douglas, it's Linda Darnell and Paul Douglas and Ann Southern and Gene Crane and Jeffrey Lynn and Florence Bates and Connie Gilchrist and Thelma Ritter.
And Letter to Three Wives.
A Letter to Three Wives, right.
Right.
I think it's the kind of movie that Hollywood has a tough time making these days. The adult humor that doesn't hit you over the head, you know, that maybe because I'm a former English teacher myself, I really like that one.
Well, and I played an English teacher.
Yes.
You know, that was Joe Mankiewicz who wrote and directed that movie. It was a very literate, amusing, charming. It really was a very good movie. I agree with you.
And I want to ask one question about it.
Yes, sir.
I hear the answer to this every now and then. I keep forgetting it. This time, I promise I'll remember. Who was the actress that did the voice role of Addie Ross? She never appeared on the screen, but I heard that every time I hear it, I thought, I think she was well known, wasn't she?
I think I know.
You know.
Wasn't it Celeste Holm?
You know, I think you're right.
Oh, Okay.
I'm not sure, but I'll take Milt's word for it.
Well, I promise I'll remember it this time
okay.
anyway.
I read that someplace. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank
you. We'll pause for a last quick round of commercials, and then back to the phones on 591-7200. I see one line actually open and available for whoever reaches first.
This is WGN Radio Chicago. You're listening to Extension 720. Here again, your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And directly back to the phones for questions. They haven't been comments, they've been questions, which seems appropriate. To Kirk Douglas, whose new novel, Dance with the Devil, is really excellent, compelling reading, and done in the style and the accents of a popular novel, does indeed raise some very serious questions about human existence and its meaning. Dance with the Devil, published by Random House, and we go back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. Mr. Douglas, the prior callers have focused on some of your bravura acting roles. I wanted to talk about a film of yours that's one of my all-time favorites, The Vikings, 1957. You produced that, I believe.
That's right. That was a Briner production, yes.
I just wanted you to know that I thought the production on that movie was so evocative of the period. It didn't seem as though it was a Hollywood film. It seemed so true to life that the locations that you shot at and the costuming and just everything about that film seemed almost like a documentary of that period.
Well, you know, we actually did. I'm glad to hear you say that because we shot it, of course, in Norway. And I tell you this funny story that happened. I got an expert from Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And I wanted to get, you know, we went to the museums and we had the boats reproduced and everything, except the experts kept disagreeing with each other. So finally I had to fire all of them. But we did try to make it very authentic, and I'm glad that you noticed that.
You even used the same composer, John North, I believe, that did the score for Spartacus, if I'm not mistaken.
No, in the Vikings,
Alex North, excuse me.
No, not Alex North, who's a wonderful composer. I think in the Vikings we used an Italian composer, because I remember him giving me the theme.
That was
Viking
a wonderful theme.
Yes.
In any case, one of my favorite lines in all of moviedom is, Hail Einar, Hail Ragnar. I've always gotten a kick out of that. And thank
Hail
you very
Einar,
much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ernest Borgnine was much scarier than you were, though, in that one.
He is much
scarier.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a wonderful... you know, it's fun to make a movie like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's the fellow who just called in, he's absolutely right. We tried to make that very authentic in all the things that happened, to make it as historically accurate as we can, as we could, and still make an exciting adventure picture. I enjoyed doing that.
It was visually very compelling. It had a strong visual aspect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let's see, where do we go now? We go to this call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I'm just so thrilled to get through it. I had a number of questions to ask Kirk Douglas, and it's such an honor talking to you, Mr. Douglas.
Yes. Thank you.
Sure. I've seen many of your movies, and I'm a big fan, but I think a question that should be answered today that I... very much interested in is what advice would you give to young actors today? Because I plan to follow that path.
Well, you know, you asked the wrong man that question because I have four sons. I've discouraged all of my sons from ever going into this business because I think the entertainment field is so tough. It's so poignant. It's so filled with rejections. Very often people say the definition of an actor is someone who loves rejection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very tough.
Well, I know it.
So all I can say is if this is what you really want to do,
definitely,
then you should do it. But it ain't easy.
Mm-hmm. But I was referring to, would you go to the academies or would you start out?
Well, what I did is try to get the best education I could. I graduated 4 years of college. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, which is a good dramatic school.
Mm-hmm.
There are several good dramatic schools. And then, if you insist on being that, I would say try to get some training. Try to do what we call summer stock, or try to play in some little theater and get some experience on the stage, and then develop your craft and see what happens.
Okay.
Sir, thank you for the call. What do you think makes a good actor? Let me put that even more directly. Is there any psychological quality or psychological pattern that is common to really first-rate actors?
Well, I don't know whether there's a psychological pattern, Milt, but I think It isn't just talent. Well, you could become a good actor, but what makes someone a star, for example, is a quality. It's something that comes off the screen. You see, it's like they say sometimes people have a quality, the camera likes you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something happens. It's an indefinable something. You can learn all the techniques of acting and all that, but if you lack that certain quality, you can never be a star. And very often, I think some people become stars and are not really fine actors, but they have.
Oh, I'm sure that's
true. You know,
true.
They have that. They have a certain quality that the audience responds to.
Who comes to mind that we may or may not have mentioned already tonight? Just to
well,
kind of illustrate.
Brando.
Brando, surely. Yeah.
Brando certainly. Barrymore,
uh-huh.
Who goes way back. But why I mention Barrymore is very often it's difficult to think of a handsome man as a good actor. Somehow a handsome person, just like a beautiful woman, gets penalized. See, it's hard to think of a handsome man as being a good actor. You always think of character actors as being the great actors. But Barrymore, for example, was an example of someone who was a very handsome man, but an extremely talented actor.
Yeah. Let's see. Back to the phones. And here is another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kirk.
Hello, how are you?
I feel as though I know you.
Well, I hope you do. If you've seen
always
a few of my movies and read a few of my novels, you'll know a lot about me.
I've seen them all. I just love you.
Thank you.
And, you know, I'm thinking of the movie Circus with your friend Bert.
Yes.
One of the most fascinating, exciting, beautiful. It just fills my mind with color and beauty. Did you like it?
Very much, and I thank you very much for thinking of it.
Well, as I remember it, you had a special reason for liking that movie, or rather something rather special happened during the making of that movie. Am I wrong?
I read your book, Kirk. It was just beautiful.
The Circus.
Circus.
Or isn't that the name of the film?
That's no name of a film that
But there's a film that you do that has a circus setting.
The only movie that I did with a circus setting. Now, you may be thinking of the movie that Burt Lancaster did.
All right. But
with trapeze.
Trapeze, that
that's
is
the
it.
One.
That is it. Oh, my goodness. I was thinking of so many waiting here, talking, and I said, I know I've got it wrong, but, you know, it has.
You know, Bert and I have done, like, about 7 movies together, and we have a pact. If someone comes up to him and says, Kirk Douglas, can I have your autograph? He signs his name.
I know,
and if
that.
Someone comes up to me and says, Mr. Lancaster, can I have your autograph? I sign his name.
Question.
A question here
on this subject, though I face a little bit of confusion. What was the film, The Story of Three Loves?
Ah, that had a
that had
but
a
that was
setting.
Not with Bert.
No, it wasn't with Bert, it was with Pierangeli.
That was with Pierangeli, and that was a trapeze picture that I did. As a matter of fact, did before Bert did trapeze.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was. Oh, you may have been thinking of that. I did that with Pierangeli, and we were swinging from a trapeze like mad.
Right.
That was it.
And as you
right.
say in The Ragman's Son, our romance started 30 feet above the earth.
That's correct. That's
well,
correct.
Well, Kirk, I was so happy to speak to you.
Thank you.
And I love you and Anne when you're in the those beautiful papers together. You just look so immaculate and beautiful, both of you.
Well, you're very sweet to call, and I'll tell my wife that when I get home.
Would you please?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, ma'am. And let us go to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. I am so happy to be speaking with both of you. I listen almost every evening. Mr. Douglas,
yes.
I am so happy to get the opportunity to tell you how much I enjoyed all of your films. I've been a fan also for 30 to 40 years.
Well, I appreciate that.
Most particularly comes to mind a film that has not been mentioned this evening, and that was The Glass Menagerie.
Yes, I did that quite a few years ago.
Yes, and someone was addressing earlier, you're being such a nice guy. I kind of think, were playing very much yourself in that film. There was none of the frustration and the lust and the power that we see in all of your other films and enjoy so much, but you played such a wonderful, warm, caring human being whose name was Jim O'Connor, I believe.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'd forgotten that. That's right. Yeah, it was a lovely guy. Nice. The gentleman caller. Yes,
gentleman
that was a
caller.
Yeah, that was lovely. I'm glad that you mentioned that. Sometimes I forget some of these movies that I made. That
I'm
was quite
afraid
a few years
I have
ago.
Forgotten that one. I don't remember that you did The Glass Menagerie.
Sure.
Who else was in it?
Sure, with Gertrude Lawrence, Arthur Kennedy. We remember, don't we?
Yes, we do. And we remember so well, you were speaking of Mr. Brando doing nothing so well. A scene in that film, Glass Menagerie, comes to mind when you listened to Gertrude Lawrence so well each time you were, while you were eating dinner, and she went on so, the great actress that she is, you did nothing beautifully in that film.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. Good night.
Good night.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call. We have room now for a few more calls. 591-7200 is the number. Now, I wonder how that film escaped me.
Well, Milt, I'm glad that that film escaped you because, you know, I've been here being amazed by the movies that you've seen, the movies that you remember, the details that you remember. And I'm thinking, my gosh, I'm in this business. I better keep on my toes. So I'm glad to hear, Milt, that you forgot about Glass Menagerie. Yes, I did that movie.
If we talked about the films of the last 10 years, I would be absolutely at a loss, though. I've seen them, but I find them more forgettable than the films of the 30s, and the war years were mostly given over to war films, most of which are not terribly memorable, though they were appropriate propagandistically at
patriotic.
The time. Patriotic. But then the films of the immediate post-war era, for the 15 years or so after the end of the war.
Well, like what we talked about earlier, Milt, the movies then were based more on character relationships, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that they tend to go away from that, you know. They tend to lean a little bit too heavily on violence, special effects. But I think that they do still make a few movies that are that count on character relationships, and I think they'll be making more of them.
So we've talked mostly tonight, when we've talked about film, about American films. But, of course, there are other industries elsewhere in the world, and there were other great film centers just staying within our own general range of civilization, not thinking about Indian or Chinese films or even Japanese. But we had great English films and great French films for a long time, and they were distinctive. They were different from what we were doing.
And great Italian films.
And great Italian films.
There's a film I saw recently, an Italian film, Cinema Paradiso,
mm-hmm.
which was really a tribute to the old movies. As a matter of fact, they had a short scene of a movie that I did in Italy, Ulysses, in that. But I thought that was a charming movie. And look, you see, we always talk about American movies and Hollywood. And why is Hollywood the greatest maker of movies in all the world? For the most part, Milt, it is because we embrace talent from all over the world. Because don't forget, in Hollywood, you will find talent from Australia, England, Germany, from all over the world. So really, when you think of Hollywood movies, it still is more of an international art form than a strictly American art form. Mm.
There was, for a while, a sort of British colony in Hollywood. At least I used to read about
it. There always is a British colony in Hollywood.
They get out and play cricket and do things of that sort.
Oh, years ago, of course, there was even before my time, there was a real tea-drinking a British colony. There isn't one to that extent now, but there's quite a few of them.
Here's another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Milt.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I want to say how much I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm so happy you have Mr. Kirk Douglas on tonight.
Well, thank you. I, of course.
A question to Mr. Douglas.
Yes, sir.
One of my favorite movies, because two people I always enjoyed while I was growing up were you and Robert Mitchum. And one of the favorite movies was The List of Adrian Messenger, if you remember that.
Yeah, my company made that.
Is that right?
Yes.
And one of the things I like about that movie is it keyed me to both you and Robert Mitchum as being good actors at that time. And it seems to me like a portion of your career changed, or you changed the way you acted and the way you did things. Do you feel that way or not?
Well, yeah. Well, List of Adrian Messenger was, to me, an interesting movie. It never came off as well as I had hoped it could, but all of us were trying to do something a little different. I think that's true, and I think that's what you're referring to.
It was an exceptionally fine film. I remember it very well. I believe John Huston directed it, is that right?
That's right.
And was shot in Ireland, I suppose.
A lot of it.
Yeah.
Well, that, as a matter of fact, was wrong. John at that time wanted to get a trip to Ireland, so he decided we ought to shoot some of the scenes in Ireland. I wanted it to be much more of a campy film. I wanted it to be a crazier film just went from one thing to another, and you didn't... You know, we had a wild cast in this. Sinatra played a part.
Oh, yes.
Lancaster.
Marlene Dietrich.
Mitchum. No, Marlene wasn't in that.
Wasn't she in there?
No. Tony Curtis. It was quite a few, you know, it was sort of a guessing game.
Yeah.
Who's who?
Yeah. We're just about out of time.
That's
I've saved
right.
the most annoying for the last. I trot this question out only a few times for people who've got some maturity and who've got considerable accumulated wisdom and rich experience. And I guess this is my cliche number three for the night. It's simply this. What have you learned about life?
Well, of course, that is quite a heavy question to throw on.
And you've got about 30 seconds.
30 seconds. I think what you learn about life is that you don't know as much as you think. And what I have learned is that you have to keep being open. You have to dare to be a little naive. Don't be afraid to be a little childish. Be open. Be receptive. Because if you're not, you lock yourself out to a lot of wonderful things that happen to life. So I think that you have to keep being receptive. That keeps you young. That keeps you have to listen to what your kids tell you. Don't always be telling them what to do. I now listen to what my four sons say to me. So I think the thing is to try to be receptive, to try to be naive, and I think that keeps you happier and younger.
That's one of the best answers I've heard to that question. I've tested it out on a number of people. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed your being here today.
I've enjoyed
Thank
it too.
Thank you so much. The new novel by Kirk Douglas is Dance with the Devil, Random House, the publishers. Again, thanks to all for listening. Thanks certainly to Kirk Douglas for a memorable evening and a good night to all.